The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Today, Her Majesty the Queen becomes the country's longest reigning monarch. And it is, of course, typical of her selfless sense of service that she would have us treat this day just like any other. But, Mr. Speaker, while I rarely advocate disobeying Her Majesty, least of all in her own Parliament, I do think it's right that today we should stop and take a moment as a nation to mark this historic milestone and to thank Her Majesty for the extraordinary service that she's given to our country over more than six decades. Mr. Speaker, Her Majesty the Queen inspires us all with her incredible service, her dignified leadership, and the extraordinary grace with which she carries out her duties.
So much of press today and really leading up to this day has commented on her selfless, service-oriented attitude, her sacrifice, as Mr. Cameron brought out there. On this day, Queen Elizabeth II becomes the longest reigning monarch in Britain's history. Quite a milestone indeed, as he said. And what a distinguished history it is, not only for Queen Elizabeth, but for Britain itself. She passes, Queen Elizabeth does, she passes Queen Victoria, her great-great-grandmother, who was on the throne for 63 years and 7 months. Going back to the 1950s, 1952 to be exact, Queen Elizabeth was just 25 years old when she ascended to the throne of Britain after the death of her father, King George VI. The official coronation came the following year and was one of the first major public events to be televised in Britain. An estimated 27 million people watched Queen Elizabeth's coronation on television. Another 11 million listened on radio. But going back to the character of this woman, as the Prime Minister, British Prime Minister David Cameron said, she's been a real rock of stability in a world of constant change. And she's maintained this selfless sense of service throughout her reign. The Spectator says the Queen's own patriotism, a faith in the courage and character of her subjects, has informed her approach to her reign. Her approach has been one of service. Her daily schedule would alarm and exhaust someone half her age. She continues on, serving, even in old age, serving tirelessly. I want to take you back to a speech she gave in 1947. This is even before she was queen. She's Princess Elizabeth, just 21 at the time. These are some remarks she made on her 21st. It's a fairly lengthy clip, but listen along, as it has a lot that's packed into it. It's from her 21st birthday, and the speech was given in 1947.
As I speak to you today from Cape Town, I am 6,000 miles from the country where I was born. But I am certainly not 6,000 miles from home. Everywhere I have traveled, in these lovely lands of South Africa and Rhodesia, my parents, my sister and I, have been taken to the heart of their people and made to feel that we are just as much at home here as if we had lived among them all our lives. That is the great privilege belonging to our place in the worldwide commonwealth, that there are homes ready to welcome us in every continent of the earth. Before I am much older, I hope I shall come to know many of them. Although there is none of my father's subjects, from the oldest to the youngest, whom I do not wish to greet, I am thinking especially today of all the young men and women who were born about the same time as myself and have grown up like me in terrible and glorious years of the Second World War. Will you, the youth of the British family of nations, let me speak on my birthday as your representative? Now that we are coming to manhood and womanhood, it is surely a great joy to us all to think that we shall be able to take some of the burden off the shoulders of our elders who have fought and worked and suffered to protect our childhood. Most of you have read in the history books the proud saying of William Pitt that England had saved herself by her exertions and would save Europe by her example. But in our time, we may say that the British Empire has saved the world first and has now to save itself after the battle is won. I think that is an even finer thing than was done in the days of Pitt. And it is for us who have grown up in these years of danger and glory to see that it is accomplished in the long years of peace that we all hope stretch ahead. If we all go forward together with an unwavering faith, a high courage, and a quiet heart, we shall be able to make of this ancient commonwealth, which we all love so dearly, an even grander thing, more free, more prosperous, more happy, and a more powerful influence for good in the world than it has been in the greatest days of our forefathers. To accomplish that, we must give nothing less than the whole of ourselves. There is a motto which has been borne by many of my ancestors, a noble motto, I serve. Those words were an inspiration to many bygone heirs to the throne when they made their knightly dedication as they came to manhood. I cannot quite do as they did, but through the inventions of science, I can do what was not possible for any of them. I can make my solemn act of dedication with a whole empire listening. I should like to make that dedication now. It is very simple. I declare before you all that my whole life, whether it be long or short, shall be devoted to your service and to the service of our great imperial family to which we all belong. But I shall not have strength to carry out this resolution alone unless you join in it with me, as I now invite you to do. I know that your support will be unfailingly given. God help me to make good my vow, and God bless all of you who are willing to share in it.
Those inspiring words coming from Princess Elizabeth back in 1947 when she was just 21 years old, 2 years after World War II, talking about those terrible and glorious years, terrible and glorious at the same time. Speaking of the burden that many of the adults of her day had to carry on their shoulders. Calling upon the young to lift that burden during the days of peace. And then making that noble vow, that noble motto, I serve, as she said, declaring that all her life, and it would turn out to be a long one, would be devoted to your service, to the service of our great imperial family, she said. Now, she's done a pretty remarkable job living up to that. As you can see from so many of the reports this week, as you heard there from Prime Minister Cameron, all the charity work that she does, the pace that she keeps, the fact that she has a schedule, as the Spectator pointed out, that would exhaust and alarm people half her age. She keeps on serving and giving. And yet at the same time, when you consider how selfless she's been, look at what's happened to the empire that she's presided over. She said she couldn't do it alone. She needed everyone in the empire to also strive for that noble, noble motto, I serve. A lot of comparisons are being made between Queen Elizabeth II, her reign, and Queen Victoria, the one she passes today, in terms of the length of the reign. These two great queens. But go back a century and a half to Queen Victoria's day. It was during her reign that the British Empire covered one-fourth of the globe. She ruled over 400 million subjects, Queen Victoria. This was the greatest empire that Earth had ever seen. Controlled from just a tiny island nation. Where did it summon all the strength to colonize the world's greatest pieces of land? To govern so many people. 1/4 of the world. That's awesome to think on. It controlled all of the Earth's critical sea lanes. It had the world's most powerful navy. But look at where it is today. Even with the noble sacrifices that Queen Elizabeth II has made, look at what's happened to the empire. Since the day she gave that speech in 1947, 2 years after the great World War II, that dreadful, that terrible war, and also that glorious time when Britain saved Western civilization. Today, the empire is gone. The Boston Globe, earlier this year, said that by 2020, the British Army will have fewer soldiers than at any time since the Napoleonic Wars. The once proud Royal Navy currently deploys no working aircraft carrier. All of this stunning demise, it's happened during this long reign, 63 years, 7 months. And we've seen the empire just crumble before us. Queen Elizabeth's first parliament was during the days of Winston Churchill. And now Britain barely survives. Herbert Armstrong talked about this demise in the United States and Britain in prophecy. Britain being reduced to a second-rate power. Coming out of that great war she spoke of, Queen Elizabeth, in that speech from 1947, that war and the one before it, the two world wars just decimated Britain of its strength, its manpower. And we witnessed the slow and steady process of that empire devolving into a commonwealth. And now we see Britain today trying to join a European project or be part of a European project, and then now trying to get out of it. And you go back to Herbert Armstrong's articles and books and booklets, what he said in the Plain Truth magazine. All of it was laid out there in incredible detail. the economic problems that Britain would face, the struggles with defining its Commonwealth, the civil strife, the racial tension, the burgeoning and unsustainable welfare system, laziness, preoccupation with entertainment, immoral entertainment, drunkenness. The sick man of Europe. That's what one Plain Truth article spoke of when talking about the sickness in Britain. The big question, the Plain Truth, 1966, the big question, what will it take to wake up the people of Britain? Yes, what will it take? What will it take for people to wake up? Well, you can look at this world, as we've covered on this program, and see that this is, to paraphrase what the princess said back in 1947, it's a terrible time in so many ways. And yet, as stunning as this demise has been, the throne is still there. The monarchy is still there. Why didn't the British monarchy collapse along with the empire? As the empire crumbled, why didn't that throne crumble along with it? The Spectator, the one I quoted from a moment ago, it says the British monarchy could easily have crumbled in 1936 or fallen with the empire or been weakened by the marital scandals of the 1990s. That the crown has never been stronger is largely down to the strength of character of the queen herself. She has preserved and strengthened the monarchy through humility and patriotism. Well, I think you could argue that the crown has definitely been stronger. You could say that she didn't exactly strengthen it, but it has been preserved. There's no doubting that. And I think you can say that God used this woman, this remarkable queen, to preserve the monarchy, to preserve the throne. If you go back in the history even, leading up to her coronation, as a young princess, she wasn't even expected to become monarch. Her father, George VI, only took the crown when his elder brother, Edward VIII, abdicated it in 1936 so that he could go and marry an American woman who had been divorced. And so all of that set the stage for this remarkable reign. This reign in which we've seen the demise of an empire, no doubt about that. But God preserved the throne. Is that significant? God used this remarkable woman, no doubt about it. He used her to help preserve David's throne. David's throne. Even through the prophesied collapse of a God-given empire, only God could work out something such as this. And so much of this is talked about in the United States and Britain in prophecy. The blessings of Abraham being taken away, but God keeping the promise that he made to David. Joel Hilliker writes about this at thetrumpet.com today in an article commemorating the now record reign of Queen Elizabeth II. Go to thetrumpet.com and read what he has to say and listen to what he has to say next on the Trumpet Hour, which will come to you at the top of the hour. You're listening right now to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3. on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is at kpcg.fm. Send us your email, your feedback, your requests for literature, anything you'd like, to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Why did Great Britain have such a positive influence on the world? Was it because Britain was just better? Were the British inherently more powerful and more equitable? Great Britain spread not only its language, but advancements in agriculture, industry, science, commerce, banking, infrastructure, education, and the list goes on. Entire nations, great nations, have their common law and their representative governments because of the influence of Great Britain. The empire served its own interests, to be sure, but it also advanced its beliefs. It spent much of its treasure, its sailors, its soldiers, and its lives to fight slavery and to rid the world of barbarous practices. Not always because it was economical, but because it was right. Where did those beliefs come from? What were those laws based on? Some may argue that they're just common sense. Some may say that the British are, or were, inherently a better people. Britain's laws were better. Its virtues were better. But not because its people were naturally better. It's because of what Britain's laws were based on. British law traces back beyond the Empire. It traces back beyond England, Scotland, Wales, or Ireland. It traces back through Britain's earliest ancestors. This heritage reaches back not hundreds of years, but thousands of years. It links directly back to a surprising yet familiar source. The virtues and laws of Great Britain don't trace back to a few philosophers and theorists scattered across the past few centuries. They aren't the result of impersonal forces and random historical texts. They trace back to one source. That source was an absolutely perfect law and government. And through the centuries and the millennia, the tighter Britain has clung to that source, the better its laws have been. Understanding that source explains where and why our British ancestors succeeded, and where and why they failed. And more to the point, it explains what we today so sorely lack. To find out where British culture originated, read Britain's 4,000-year-old history. This book is adapted from The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong. That book was read by 6 million people around the world. Far more than a Times bestseller. Request Britain's 4,000-year-old history and prove the identity and future of Britain for yourself. The Trumpet Daily.
Nice. We could listen to that all day. That was sung by the choir at Queen Elizabeth II's coronation back in 1953. That particular piece there was the choir at, or the choir of Westminster Abbey. An inspiring anthem, for sure. And what a rich history is associated with that throne that God has preserved. The monarchy could have easily crumbled right along with the empire or with all of the scandals that emerged in the 1990s. But it has remained in large part because of this remarkable woman with such a selfless attitude, a real servant of the people. A lot of comparisons, as I said before the break, being made between Queen Elizabeth II and Queen Victoria. Queen Victoria knew quite a lot about the history associated with that throne. This is from the London Sun back in 1837 when Queen Victoria ascended to the throne. This newspaper says, between the seat and this board is enclosed a stone cut. This is talking about King Edward's chair and the stone of destiny. This article says, commonly called Jacob's. Jacob's pillar stone. History relates that it is the stone whereon the patriarch Jacob laid his head in the plains of Luz. That's just from the London Sun, that's all. That's just the newspaper reporting of the day back in 1837, talking about Jacob's pillar stone. Let's look at some of that history. It's talked about in Genesis 28. Read along with me. Herbert Armstrong brings out in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that it wasn't that long ago. It wasn't that long ago when they actually had a sign next to King Edward's chair in Westminster Abbey that referred to that stone as Jacob's pillar stone. Of course, a lot has happened since they removed that sign. Now the stone's been removed. It's up in Scotland at Edinburgh Castle. And Britain has forgotten much of this history. Genesis 28 and verse 10, and Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran, and he lighted upon a certain place and tarried there all night because the sun was set. And he took of the stones of that place and put them for his pillows and lay down in that place to sleep. He took of the stones, plural, and he put those stones for his pillows, as it says there, wrapping them evidently in some kind of coat or cloth. And down in verse 16, it says, Jacob awaked out of his sleep, and he said, surely the Lord is in this place. I knew it not. Something dramatic happened here while he was sleeping. And he was afraid, verse 17 says, and said, how dreadful is this place? This is none other but the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. Something awesome happened during the night. Jacob realized that God was there. He realized God was there. He was in the presence of God. He said, how dreadful is this place? Which actually means, if you look at the Hebrew, it means that he was trembling with joy. And Jacob rose up early in the morning and took the stone that he had put for his pillows, and he set it up for a pillar and poured oil upon the top of it. So now it became a single pillar stone, a tremendous miracle. And Jacob anointed that stone. And this is the beginning. This is the beginning of Britain's stone of destiny. As the London Sun put it back in 1837, between the seat and this board is enclosed a stone commonly called Jacob's. History relates that it's the same stone whereupon the patriarch Jacob laid his head in the plains of Luz. Pretty amazing history. As Mr. Armstrong brings out in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, kings throughout history, from Ireland, from Scotland, from England, they've been coronated sitting over this stone, the same one that Queen Elizabeth II sat over in 1953. Well, many have forgotten this history, as I say. The sign that identified the stone, that was removed. I don't remember which year. The stone was removed. That was back in the 1990s, 1996, 1997. And of course, the people of Britain, their faith has degenerated. Their awareness of their own history has been lost. They've lost so much of the knowledge of their own history, their own heritage, their own identity. I spoke the other day about Winston Churchill and how upon visiting Blenheim Palace, he was reminded of his history. He looked forward to visiting places such as that, where he could think on just how distinguished his background really was, where he could think on the reputation that he was here to uphold. Coming back to this passage, notice verse 19, Genesis 28, it says, "And he called the name of the place Bethel, but the name of that city was called Luz at the first." Just like it's referenced there in the London Sun from 1837. Jacob, where he laid his head in the plains of Luz. Verse 22 says, "And this stone, which I have set for a pillar, shall be God's house. And of all that you shall give me, I will surely give the tenth unto you." So this stone on which Jacob slept, this would go on to have great significance throughout Israel's history. As you can find references in the Old Testament to kings associated with the throne in Jerusalem being coronated over or near this stone of destiny, this pillar stone. Going back to the London Sun article, 1837, again, it says this stone was conveyed to Ireland by way of Spain about 700 years before Christ, and there it was taken to Scotland by King Fergus about 370 years later, and in the year 350 BC, it was placed in the Abbey of Scone. This antique regal chair, having together with the golden scepter and crown of Scotland, being solemnly offered by King Edward I to St. Edward the Confessor in the year 1297, from whence it derives the appellation of St. Edward's Chair, has ever since been kept in the chapel called by his name. That's some of the history. Even in that article, it takes you back to 700 years before Christ. 2,700 years ago. Of course, it goes back even further than that. It goes back to Genesis 28, as we just read there. Let's look at more history surrounding this stone, the book of Joshua, Joshua chapter 24. Joshua 24, and we'll just look at a couple of verses here. Verse 26, it says, "And Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law of God, and took a great stone and set it up there under an oak that was by the sanctuary of the Eternal." So Joshua wrote out the words of this book, and he set it up by this great stone. Why would a stone have such great significance in Joshua 24, or in Westminster Abbey, or in the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II, or Queen Victoria? Why would this stone be considered so important that the people of Scotland would want it back and put into Edinburgh Castle? What's the significance of this stone and its history? Verse 27, it says, "And Joshua said unto all people, Behold, this stone shall be a witness unto us. For it has heard all the words of the Eternal which he spoke unto us. It shall be therefore a witness unto you, lest you deny your God." This great stone was to be a stone of witness, among other things. Jacob's pillar stone, a stone of destiny. It reminded Israel of its covenant with God. It was there with Israel through thick and thin. It was all throughout the history. There with God's people. Notice it says that this stone shall. It shall be a witness unto us. That's talking about the future as well. What a witness it is, even to this day. That stone, the throne, the monarchy. God has preserved the monarchy. God has preserved it. Why? Even as we've seen the empire virtually disappear, the monarchy could have easily crumbled back in the 1930s. It could have easily fallen with the empire. Or it could have been severely weakened by all the scandals from the 1990s. As it is, it's still going strong. It's still going strong. Why? Why has the British monarchy continued, even as the empire has collapsed? It's something to consider. What a witness that throne of David is. What a witness that stone, Jacob's pillar stone, is for our people today. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial. The live stream's available at kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. On today's Trumpet Hour.
This is Joel Hilliker, host of Trumpet Hour. On our next show today, Queen Elizabeth passes Queen Victoria as the longest reigning monarch in England's history. We're going to talk about the reason Britain's royal family has endured. Europe's refugee crisis is a story you really need to understand the significance of. We're going to talk to trumpet writer Brad McDonald in Britain about why it's so concerning and what it means for Europe's future. In the U.S., the Environmental Protection Agency just realized that it has a whole lot more power than ever, and it plans to use it. We'll talk about the effects that this could have on America's economy. I'm also going to give you some pretty simple advice about the last thing you do at night that will really make your day. All this on today's Trumpet Hour.
Tune in to the next Trumpet Hour. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
This time as we did in the segment before. It's a beautiful song, though. Zadok the Priest. A couple of years ago, after the birth of Prince George, the London Evening Standard here in the UK, it wondered if the new royal baby would be circumcised. This is from 2013, July 23rd. And notice the history it discusses here. It's pretty amazing. It says, Queen Victoria, convinced that the British royal family was descended from King David, had all her male offspring circumcised. It just mentions that in passing. The paper wonders if the baby, Prince George, will be circumcised. And then it says, well, Queen Victoria did it with her offspring because she was convinced that the British royal family was descended from King David. Where would she have gotten such an idea? Why did she think that? Why was she convinced? It's a remarkable statement. The London Evening Sun or Evening Standard said that because of that, that the procedure, circumcision, it continued right up to our day with Prince Charles. And now we have the next generation, his children, and then now a new baby. Why would Queen Victoria, though, be convinced that the British royal family was descended from King David? Well, it all revolves around the covenant that God made with David. The covenant that you can read about in 2 Samuel 7 and elsewhere, all through the Bible. Did Queen Victoria know that she was not only a descendant of David, King David, but that she was actually sitting on David's throne? The very throne from which Jesus Christ will rule this earth at his return? Well, who knows how much of God's purpose she understood, but she certainly understood some of the history. How much of that is remembered today, even among the members of the royal family? Here again, you go back to some of the more common reporting, whether it's Queen Victoria's Day in the 1800s, this piece here from 1933 from a publication called the Dundee Courier and Advertiser. This is April 18th, 1933, a chart in the possession of the royal family, which was said to trace the descent of Britain's line of kings from the biblical King David, was mentioned by Mr. Bernard L. Bateson in an address in Dundee last night. So this piece, this article, is talking about a speech that was made in Dundee. Mr. Bateson explained that last century, the famous Professor Milner had gone thoroughly into the matter and compiled a chart showing the British royal house's descent from King David, and he had sent the chart to Queen Victoria. He was summoned to Windsor Castle, where the Queen showed him another chart on exactly the same lines, which she said had always been in the possession of the royal family. So it's going back to this individual that had had interaction with the Queen during her reign. And she showed him a chart, evidently, that was very similar to the one he had prepared. There was another newspaper story back in 1894 which referred to this chart, the royal family tree, as a, quote, very sacred object to Her Majesty, referring to Queen Victoria. That was from 1894. But switching back to this Dundee Courier, it says it was on record in the annals of Ireland, continued the speaker, that a daughter of a biblical king had married the king of Ulster and brought with her the Stone of Destiny. This reigning family was transferred to Scotland with the stone, which Jacob had used as a pillow, and later the same family came to rule Great Britain. And the Stone of Destiny now lay in Westminster Abbey. You talk about some fascinating history. That's the kind of history you don't want to let go of. This one article is touching on all kinds of long-forgotten history about the stone, about the royal family, about the stone's travels from the area around Jerusalem into Ireland, into Scotland, into England. It alludes to the mysterious commission that God gave to Jeremiah. This is from 1878. The Huddersfield Daily Chronicle says an American clergyman has made a startling historical discovery. According to him, about the year 580 BC, the prophet Jeremiah sailed from Palestine in a ship which landed him on the northern coast of Ireland. Jeremiah took with him a princess of the house of David, whom Queen Victoria is a lineal descendant. That's amazing. There's quite a few other sources here. Frederick Glover's work, England, the Remnant of Judah. He originally published his book back in the 1860s. It didn't get much attention until the second edition came out in 1881. You can find a copy of that on Google Books today. Much of this is out there just because of technology. You heard that clip in segment one with Queen Elizabeth, just talking about how far-reaching her message could be because of the power of television, and how that everyone could then become familiar with this noble motto. I serve. She said it. She's tried to live up to it. But can the rest in Britain say the same? I declare before you all that my whole life, whether it be long or short, shall be devoted to your service and the service of our great imperial family to which we all belong. What a great imperial family it is. If only they knew just how great it is, how deep the roots go, and why God has preserved that throne. Even as the empire has crumbled. Well, these are some of the secular sources that are out there. I'll quote one more. 1884, the Sheffield and Rotherham Independent. It says, a lecture in connection with the association was delivered last night. This is a report on another speech or meeting at the Cutler's Hall by Mr. W.S. Cavill on Queen Victoria, David's heir. That's the speech. That was the lecture. I don't know who all these speakers were. Maybe some of them were theologians. Maybe all of them were. In any event, they were traveling the country, lecturing. And there was a large enough audience in these cases for it to receive coverage in the newspapers, in the local newspapers. It says the lecturer maintained that it was God's intention that there should be royalty in Israel and that the throne of David was established forever. Is that really that far-fetched? It's just what God said. As I say, read 2 Samuel 7. Read Psalm. I think it's Psalm 89. It says then, this is the article, then he traced the royal line through the kings of Israel down to Zedekiah, and pointed out that one of Zedekiah's daughters was brought from the east to Ireland. His lecture, which abounded with biblical quotations, was listened to with great attention by a large audience, to whom he averred that Her Majesty Queen Victoria was really King David's heiress. That's 1884. A large audience. He believed it. Well, the Sheffield and Rotherham Independent didn't seem to scoff at that notion. And if we're to believe this other report that I gave you, Queen Victoria herself believed it. They didn't scoff. They didn't ridicule this idea. They were proud of that heritage. And as it happens, and see if you can make a connection here, as it happens, this was at a time when the British Empire was right at its peak. When the British Empire controlled one-fourth of the world. Queen Victoria believed it. So did a number of theologians, scholars, and historians who wrote about it in articles, pamphlets, booklets, books. I'm not saying everyone in the UK agreed with it or believed it or even knew about it back then. But a lot of people did, certainly a lot more than do today. Today, if you just go through this history, this truth, these promises in 2 Samuel 7, if you just go through it, Most people, no doubt, would scoff and ridicule that truth. Well, even today, maybe we shouldn't say most, because the United States and Britain in prophecy was distributed to 6 million households around the world. 6 million. And so there were a lot, evidently, who didn't scoff, who are fascinated by this history, who are aware of these roots, these historical roots, these unbreakable promises of God, the history and the prophecy associated with this throne. If you want to study into this further, you've got to go and get the book for yourself. The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Send us a request. Send your request to td@kpcg.fm. And we'll send you a book at no cost or obligation. We'll send it out to you today. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream, of course, is available at kpcg.fm. Don't forget to stay tuned to the next program that plays at the top of the hour, Trumpet Hour, hosted by Joel Hilliker. We thank you, as always, for joining us today, and we'll look forward to speaking with you again tomorrow.